Microsoft.
We were smoked. That was the blunt email sent to four colleagues by Jim Alchin, the Microsoft executive in charge of Windows development, at 5 p.m. the day he saw the iTunes store. It had only one other line. How did they get the music companies to go along? Later that evening, a reply came from David Cole, who was running Microsoft's online business group. When Apple brings this to Windows, I assume they won't make the mistake of not bringing it to Windows, we will really be smoked. He said that the Windows team needed to bring this kind of solution to market, adding, that will require focus and goal alignment around an end-to-end service which delivers direct user value, something we don't have today. Even though Microsoft had its own internet service, MSN, it was not used to providing end-to-end service the way Apple was. Bill Gates himself weighed in at 10:46 that night. His subject line, Apple's Jobs again, indicated his frustration. Steve Jobs' ability to focus in on a few things that count, get people who get user interface right, and market things as revolutionary are amazing things, he said. He too expressed surprise that Jobs had been able to convince the music companies to go along with his store. This is very strange to me. The music company's own operations offer a service that is truly unfriendly to the user. Somehow they decide to give Apple the ability to do something pretty good. Gates also found it strange that no one else had created a service that allowed people to buy songs rather than subscribe on a monthly basis. I am not saying this strangeness means we messed up. At least if we did, so did Reel and Pressplay and MusicNet and basically everyone else, he wrote. Now that Jobs has done it, we need to move fast to get something where the user interface and rights are as good. I think we need some plan to prove that even though Jobs has us a bit flat-footed again, we can move quick and both match and do stuff better. It was an astonishing private admission. Microsoft had again been caught flat-footed, and it would again try to catch up by copying Apple. But like Sony, Microsoft could never make it happen, even after Jobs showed the way. Instead, Apple continued to smoke Microsoft in the way that Cole had predicted. It ported the iTunes software and store to Windows. But that took some internal agonizing. First, Jobs and his team had to decide whether they wanted the iPod to work with Windows computers. Jobs was initially opposed. By keeping the iPod for Mac only, it was driving the sales of Macs even more than we expected, he recalled. But lined up against him were all four of his top executives, Schiller, Rubinstein, Robin, and Fidel. It was an argument about what the future of Apple should be. We felt we should be in the music player business, not just in the Mac business, said Schiller. Jobs always wanted Apple to create its own unified utopia, a magical walled garden where hardware and software and peripheral devices worked well together to create a great experience, and where the success of one product drove sales of all the companions. Now he was facing pressure to have his hottest new product work with Windows machines, and it went against his nature. It was a really big argument for months, Jobs recalled, me against everyone else. At one point, he declared that Windows users would get to use iPods over my dead body. But still, his team kept pushing. This needs to get to the PC, said Fidel. Finally, Jobs declared, until you can prove to me that it will make business sense, I'm not going to do it. That was actually his way of backing down. If you put aside emotion and dogma, it was easy to prove that it made business sense to allow Windows users to buy iPods. Experts were called in, sales scenarios developed, and everyone concluded this would bring in more profits. We developed a spreadsheet, said Schiller. Under all scenarios, there was no amount of cannibalization of Mac sales that would outweigh the sales of iPods. Jobs was sometimes willing to surrender, despite his reputation, but he never won any awards for gracious concession speeches. Screw it, he said at one meeting where they showed him the analysis. I'm sick of listening to you assholes. Go do whatever the hell you want. That left another question. When Apple allowed the iPod to be compatible with Windows machines, should it also create a version of iTunes to serve as the music management software for those Windows users? As usual, Jobs believed the hardware and software should go together. The user experience depended on the iPod working in complete sync, so to speak, with iTunes software on the computer. Schiller was opposed. I thought that was crazy, since we don't make Windows software, Schiller recalled. But Steve kept arguing, if we're going to do it, we should do it right. Schiller prevailed at first. Apple decided to allow the iPod to work with Windows by using software from Music Match, an outside company. But the software was so clunky that it proved Jobs' point, and Apple embarked on a fast-track effort to produce iTunes for Windows. Jobs recalled, to make the iPod work on PCs, we initially partnered with another company that had a jukebox, gave them the secret sauce to connect to the iPod, and they did a crappy job. That was the worst of all worlds, because this other company was controlling a big piece of the user experience. So we lived with this crappy outside jukebox for about 6 months, and then we finally got iTunes written for Windows. In the end, you just don't want someone else to control a big part of the user experience. People may disagree with me, but I am pretty consistent about that. Porting iTunes to Windows meant going back to all of the music companies, which had made deals to be in iTunes based on the assurance that it would be for only the small universe of Macintosh users, and negotiate again. Sony was especially resistant. Andy Lack thought it another example of Jobs changing the terms after a deal was done. It was, but by then the other labels were happy about how the iTunes store was working and went along, so Sony was forced to capitulate. Jobs announced the launch of iTunes for Windows in October 2003. Here's a feature that people thought we'd never add until this happened, he said, waving his hand at the giant screen behind him. Hell froze over, proclaimed the slide. The show included iChat appearances and videos from Mick Jagger, Dr. Dre, and Bono. It's a very cool thing for musicians and music, Bono said of the iPod and iTunes. That's why I'm here to kiss the corporate ass. I don't kiss everybody's. Jobs was never prone to understatement. To the cheers of the crowd, he declared, iTunes for Windows is probably the best Windows app ever written. Microsoft was not grateful. They're pursuing the same strategy that they pursued in the PC business, controlling both the hardware and software, Bill Gates told Business Week. We've always done things a little bit differently than Apple in terms of giving people choice. It was not until 3 years later, in November 2006, that Microsoft was finally able to release its own answer to the iPod. It was called the Zune, and it looked like an iPod, though a bit clunkier. 2 years later, it had achieved a market share of less than 5%. Jobs was brutal about the cause of the Zune's uninspired design and market weakness. The older I get, the more I see how motivations matter. The Zune was crappy because the people at Microsoft don't really love music or art the way we do. We won because we personally love music. We made the iPod for ourselves. And when you're doing something for yourself or your best friend or family, you're not going to cheese out. If you don't love something, you're not going to go the extra mile, work the extra weekend, challenge the status quo as much.